Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 19.
Hey everybody, on today's show I'll be talking to a documentary filmmaker about his latest film, Prisoners and Patriots, the untold story of Japanese internment in Santa Fe during World War II. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I am your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, I'll be talking to documentary filmmaker Neil Simon about his film, Prisoners and Patriots, the untold story of Japanese internment in Santa Fe. His film is about the internment or imprisonment of Japanese nationals in United States during World War II. As you know, during World War II, the American government moved about 100,000 Japanese off the coast of California and further inland into these internment camps. And what Neil has done is he has found many of these survivors of these camps, many of them still living in the United States, and has interviewed them about what their experience was like. It's a very interesting documentary because, as you know, many of these gentlemen are getting on in age and they're not going to be around much longer. And once they're gone, that particular chapter of World War II, that story will more or less be forgotten. So he has managed to secure interviews with a number of these survivors and has made a documentary film about it. And I'll be talking to him about his film a little bit later on in the show. But first, I want to talk about snow and earthquakes. It's so, you know, before I came to Japan, I never felt an earthquake before in my life. Even though I lived in Vancouver, which is supposed to be on that San Andreas Fault, I never felt an earthquake. And I wasn't here during the big 3.11 earthquake, thankfully, but it still feels strange to me to feel earthquakes. It just kind of doesn't really register as what's going on. And then a couple, last week on the, was it the 23rd? We had such a strange day. It started off sunny, and then it kind of clouded over, and then we had an earthquake, and then we had this massive snowfall. And it was so strange for me to see snow again because I haven't seen snow in probably about 5 years or so. I was living in Thailand before I lived in Japan, and before that I was living in Germany. But the part of Germany I was living in, I didn't get any snow, and I was living in Barcelona, Spain for a while, and that didn't get any snow. So it's been actually about 5 years or so since I've seen any snow. So when I looked outside, it was actually my good friend Hinko Simon who posted a picture on Instagram of the snow piling up in his neighborhood. When I saw that, I quickly ran outside and saw all the snow coming down. And so I grabbed my video camera and took a walk around my neighborhood and made a quick video of what the snow looked like coming down in my neighborhood. If you haven't seen that video, go on YouTube, do a search for Tokyo Podcast, and you will find my YouTube channel with all my videos posted there. But I really enjoyed seeing the snow again. It was nice to see that again, and it really makes me want to go skiing and go snowboarding again because it's something I haven't done in quite a while. And speaking of snowboarding, that leads us into this week's episode of Japan Blog News. I have two websites this week. One is the very excellent podcast put out by the LearnJapanesePod.com website. They have a weekly podcast that they put out that gives you Japanese lessons as well as news and information about what's going on in Japan. They also have a really good newsletter which you can sign up for. And in the January issue of their newsletter, they do an interview with a gentleman who runs the Merino Lodge in Hakuba, Japan. This is a ski resort located in Hakuba, and they have an excellent interview about how to get to Hakuba and some of the amenities that are available at Merino Lodge. So if you're interested in learning Japanese or interested in checking out some really great powder skiing, go to learnjapanesepod.com and register for their newsletter. The second site I want to bring to you is called A Life in Japan, and this is a short documentary film where the filmmaker interviewed a variety of foreigners to talk about their experiences in living in Japan. What I really like about this short documentary is that he covers both the positive and the negative sides of living in Japan. There's certainly a lot of benefits to living here, but there's also some challenges as well. And I find that many videos talking about living in Japan usually only show one side. Either they're really positive or they're really negative. But in this film, I thought he did a really good job of showing both sides of living in Japan, the challenges as well as the rewards. If you're a foreigner and you're thinking about moving to Japan, I think this video gives you a pretty accurate description of what it's like to live here. And if you're Japanese, you might be interested to check this video out also, because it gives you an idea of what it's like for foreigners to live here, how we see your country, which could be quite a bit different than how you see it. So if you're interested in checking out this documentary, which I highly recommend, you can buy it from the website. It's only about $5. Visit alifeinjapan.com. During World War II, the United States government detained over 100,000 people of Japanese descent in internment camps throughout the west coast of the United States. One particular camp located in Santa Fe, New Mexico, was different. It held men who were seen as the worst of the worst by the United States government. Many of these men were ministers, businessmen, journalists, or teachers, and until today, their story has never been told. Neil Simon is a documentary filmmaker whose film, Prisoners and Patriots, hopes to bring awareness to the camp in Santa Fe and this untold story from World War II. Hey, Neil, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. So can you tell us, you're not Japanese, right?
No.
So what prompted you to make a documentary film about Japanese prisoners in the United States?
Excellent question. The growing up in Portland, Oregon, I had a lot of friends, from Japan or of Japanese American heritage, and I, as a Jewish American myself, as I started to study more about World War II and what happened to some of my ancestors, obviously, I started to think more about what happened in World War II to other groups, and I happened to be living in Santa Fe. In New Mexico, actually, in 2002, when they were working on building a monument to this camp. And before then, I had never known that this camp even existed. In fact, I didn't even know that much about the regular war relocation centers that were throughout the West. And so I started learning more, and I realized that there wasn't that much out there. And in 2005, when I moved to Washington, D.C., I told myself, I'm going to look in the National Archives and see if there's a documentary, or the Library of Congress, and see if there's a film, or at least a book. But there was nothing about the Santa Fe Department of Justice camp. There was one chapter in one book. And so at that point, I said, someone has to record this story. Now, these people that were held there are in their 80s, 90s, or deceased. And if we don't talk to them and record their voices now, this will be a story that just passes on to the ages. So I quickly started doing the research to find families and to locate survivors. And the more I learned and the more people I talked to, the more I realized that the film had to be made. And it was just one of those things that I ended up committing to. And 5 years later, I'm happy to say it's getting out there.
When you kind of started this project, were you surprised that there hadn't been a film made about it?
I was really shocked. I mean, there's actually a good amount of literature about the Japanese American internment experience. There's a lot about Manzanar. There's famous people who were born or were raised or lived, during World War II in these camps that went on to the United States Senate and other places. And
right.
I think that because of those people, there is some awareness about this experience. And there are, Heart Mountain, Manzanar, sort of names that you hear about. You're like, yeah, I think that was one of those camps that the U.S. did. That was really bad. And that's kind of all people really know. They know there was this general roundup, but very rarely do people know what the Department of Justice did. This was different than rounding up the families and moving them inland for a few years. This was arresting people, separating dads from sons and daughters and wives and cousins. This was separating business owners and potential other community leaders away from the people who they had been closest to and whose communities they had helped build. This was separating Buddhist ministers from their congregations. So this was, in many ways, far worse than the act of relocation was this blatant separation of a population, which was all done by the FBI over the fears that came from wartime hysteria.
In your research, was there any evidence, did you find any evidence that these fears were justified? Like, were there Japanese spies, you know, posing as fishermen, documenting the coastline? Was there any evidence that that was discovered at all?
I mean, the short answer is no, not really. I mean, these men who were held were, by and large, not dangerous. But that said, while in camp, there is certainly evidence of groups that were organized and who were cheering on Japan to win the war. Right. And there were, obviously the Hoshidan and some of these Kibei who were educated in Japan but perhaps born in the United States, who did have a definite patriotic feeling towards Japan. And when the United States broadcasts from the media would report victories for Allied forces over Japan in different areas, often these groups would denounce these as, no, that's just the American propaganda, there's no way. I mean, really, up until the end, you had some people in the camps who were trying to make the case that, no, Japan's going to win this thing, and you know, we're not going to have anything to worry about, we're going to have the last laugh. But as, you know, the end of the war became more clear, and when the first people arrived back in Japan and started sending letters back to their families, and in some cases even to people in the camps, it was clear that, okay, this was real. This is Hiroshima. I'm here, and I'm telling you, it's over.
Right.
And so at that point, you start to see some of the changes of views. And some people who throughout their time in internment camp were, you know, perhaps proudly patriotic with their Japanese nationalism and very angry at the United States for what was happening to their own civil rights. Even at the end, when the U.S. said, you're welcome to stay in the United States, some of these people would say, oh, well, gosh, I thought, you know, once the U.S., you know, beat Japan, if I was still in this camp, that nothing better would happen for me, only worse. I'd be sent back to Japan, or who knows what would happen to me. But then when they would see that, hey, the United States was letting them stay here and letting them return back home, the survivors that I spoke to, obviously these were younger men at the time of the war because they were still alive,
right.
They would say very, very positive things about America. And that was really what surprised me, was this, not necessarily this change of heart, but this almost immediate forgiveness, this acknowledgement that I hear this sentiment that they did not want to hold a grudge. They did not want to be bitter. Almost every interview used the word bitterness in a reference to not wanting to have that emotion. And so the question, of course, is, well, is that true? I mean, in oral history, you never really know what is true. It's just oral history, what people are telling you. But for these men that I spoke to, very often their families, their daughters, they would be angry, but they themselves would not be. They would almost reflect on this understanding, and of course they'd compare their situation to others, and they would say that, you know, we were treated better than the Japanese treated some of their prisoners of war. We were treated much better, of course, than, you know, Hitler's Germany treated its prisoners. And
right.
So, of course, no one enjoyed the fact they were in camp and without their real freedoms, but they reflect after the fact on, you know, what the United States did, what they did. They were misguided by hysteria, but in the end, they sent us back to our homes. They let us stay. They, you know, so that was really interesting to me, because when I started the project, I really did think it would be, you know, all the interviews would just be very anti-American and holding a grudge for life. And it would be all about just how bad the United States was from the wartime on. But you see a lot of forgiveness and a lot of positive reflection from some of these Buddhist ministers and businessmen and others who were in the camp that happened to still be alive a few years ago or still, and talking about this experience.
What did they say about what their feelings were about during the war? Like when they're in the camp, and I mean, some of them were American citizens. They were born in America.
Yeah.
And so what were their feelings about, you know, Japan being at war with America? Did they want Japan to win? Did they want America to win? Were they worried about their own future depending on which side won? Did they talk about that?
They did, and very often the parallel they would make would be like having a divorcing parents. You know, right. Here you are, you're an American citizen. Perhaps you're born in America, but your parents are from Japan. So everything in your heritage, I mean, you're the first generation. And so these Issei men would talk about how they're loyal to America, but they love, you know, mother country Japan too.
Right.
And so it was very conflicting feeling, and especially I'm always trying to remember the age of the men that I interviewed. So, you know, these are people who were teenagers and in their 20s during World War II. Perhaps they had just finished or were in high school, and these are formative years of their life that they're going through a very tumultuous experience, and then having to reconcile this sort of fight between the parents, you know, right. And where their loyalties lie. So you've had a lot of conflicting emotions voiced by the men that I interviewed.
And you know, what's interesting too is that, you know, I did an interview recently with the ladies who made this documentary called Hafu, about people who are half Japanese and half another nationality. And one thing we kind of talked about is we asked each other, like, which do you feel more of, Japanese or you know, the other side? And it usually kind of depended on where you were born. You know, I was born in Canada and I grew up mostly in Canada, so I feel more Canadian.
Uh-huh.
So I imagine for some of these gentlemen that you interviewed, if they're born in America and they're in their 20s and they're in this camp, they probably felt 100% American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did. Yeah. They probably didn't really feel Japanese at all.
Right. Exactly. And that's where you see the biggest difference in the types of men who were in these camps. You have Issei and these Kibei who of course were educated in Japan and came back. So like you, if you were born in Canada and then say you spent junior high and high school in Japan, and then maybe sometime after college you came back to Canada, then you probably would feel different. Your Canadian identity would have lessened over those formative years of your life.
Right.
So it's completely understandable in many regards how these Kibei would have acted and how they and why they would have formed the organizations that they did in Tule Lake and other camps to really try to hold on to their Japanese national identities.
Right.
And not even out of necessarily a national patriotism, but just out of a personal identity. You know, this is who they are, and therefore this is their country. And so I could imagine very much this conflicting emotion. And whereas the Americans, who were, even if they had Japanese parents, would probably, like you say, feel more American.
Right.
This was their country that they were building a life in. This is a country where their families were building businesses in, farms in, and really, you know, doing all they could to be part of the community. And against all odds, of course, because at this time there's all, you know, still, you know, alien land exclusions and, you know, obvious discriminatory policies against, you know, property rights and legal representation for Japanese Americans.
Well, did you find any kind of conflict within the camps between the Japanese groups, perhaps ones that were first generation American and then the older generation from Japan? Was there any kind of conflict at all between them, or did they kind of bond together as one group?
I'm trying to look at just the Santa Fe experience, and I'm not an expert in all the other camps, but a lot of the men who were in Santa Fe came from Tule Lake. And in Tule Lake, you had a more diverse population.
Right.
Santa Fe, like you said in the opening, was designated for what the government saw as the worst of the worst. So if someone was acting up in another camp, chances were they were going to send him to Santa Fe. if some, you know, group was organizing and continually wearing rising sun emblems on their sweatshirts and doing these Japanese exercises and sort of military drills,
right,
they were sent to Santa Fe. So you definitely saw people in Tule Lake who would say, I don't want to be a part of that. These people are, they're goose-stepping, they're marching, they're maybe even raising a Japanese flag, they're celebrating the emperor's birthday. These are people I do not want to associate with. Let the Hoshidan do their thing. I don't want to get caught up in that because I know what the guards think of this organization. I don't want to end up how they're going to end up. And of course, end up meant being sent to Santa Fe and being separated even further from your family. Right. So I think that there was these differences in populations, but I don't think that it was necessarily hostile in any way. And even when these men were sent off, when the Hoshidan group organizers and leaders were sent off, you had so many go to the gates of Tule Lake to bid them farewell. And then same thing in Santa Fe, when people were acting up, if they were sent out, there would be big gatherings at the gate to sort of, you know, wish them a farewell. And so, and these are moments that you could imagine that the people in the camp, the prisoners themselves, perhaps being worried of, I don't want to be caught on that side. I don't want to be sent to a further detention center that would be more akin to a jail, you know, than where we are here altogether. So you see lots of letters written about this. Some letters written in code where families are saying what they used different phrases to talk about the Hoshidan group, and they would say, Uncle Dan nearly broke his neck. And when they're saying Uncle Dan, they're talking about the Hoshidan and how it's there's a fracture within the organization and it's not clear how it's going to go. So these are the types of letters in code that would be seized by the U.S. government. And then later, of course, I read them in the National Archives. And it's really interesting because I would see sort of dispassionate observations from families writing letters, not saying, you know, oh, I really hope it stays together, or I really hope it falls apart because it's detrimental to how we're being treated by the guards, but just sort of a trying to be almost like reporters and sending a letter to their family telling them, hey, what's happening with the organizations and the groups in the camp.
What was the experience like of these Japanese Americans when the roundup started? I'm sure many people have seen like Schindler's List, and we've seen lots of archival footage of Jews being rounded up, and you know it's in many movies. But I'm trying to get an idea of like what was it like for these people? Were they just suddenly rounded up? Was there a notice posted on a telephone pole, or what happened that you know when that started?
Yeah. First of all, many of the families when they talk about their fathers, and in many cases, it was the fathers first who were arrested by the FBI.
Right.
This happened the day of Pearl Harbor, the day after, the week after. These arrests were immediate. The government had been tracking and following these men for months. Mm. And despite indications that there would not be any problem with the loyalty of some of these men, that yes, they may be have some allegiance to Japan, the reports were from within the government that they would not cause any problems for the United States. That said, of course, there could not be, you know, too careful. The government took the actions they did. They were afraid of people who were watching ships at ports. They were afraid of people who were able to organize large numbers of people through their congregations or their schools. And so they acted. But these arrests were different than the later roundup, if you will, that was done under the executive order in February. So, you know, Pearl Harbor is attacked at the beginning of December. It's not until 2 months later that there's the actual exclusion zones are drawn and the evacuation is ordered. And that's what a lot of people know about is, okay, the signs are up on the post, meet at the church at, you know, this time in the morning, bring only what you can carry. And the families were off to camps. The film that I did about the internment camp in Santa Fe was for people who were arrested well before that. This camp was designed, and the Department of Justice activities were designed to go after leaders. And that meant someone arriving at home, a father not being allowed to change his clothes from working in the yard and being told, get in the car, you're gone. That meant ransacking a home and taking decorative knives, taking cameras, recorders, radios. That meant continually visiting a home, waiting for the father to return, and a family not really knowing why. And then, of course, once the father returned, he was taken. These were instances that the families reported to me about with remembering great confusion. Like, where did dad go? What was he doing? And, well, he was organizing the farm workers, and when the ambassador from Japan came a couple years ago, we helped him to meet with, you know, people here and meet with some of the Japanese, you know, expats, and, oh, maybe that's why the government had their eye on him. Or, oh, dad was involved with a Japanese golf club, and, well, maybe that's why they had an eye on him. Or, you know, dad always was helping out at the school teaching Japanese 2 days a week. That's why they took him. But it was never clear, and there was no arrest warrant, and there was, you know, there was no, in some cases there was, obviously, but there was great confusion. And so sometimes it were, a week would pass, 2 weeks would pass, and they'd find out, okay, dad's at, you know, in one case in Oregon, the Multnomah County Jail downtown. And so the family, you know, maybe one time was able to visit him there, and next thing you know, he was gone and taken to Santa Fe or to another camp as a holding place before Santa Fe. And so the families, aside from the pain of the moment of having your dad taken away, very often would reflect this confusion of, well, why exactly? And for how long? And where is he? And can we see him? And this was the pain of the beginning of the war. And this was the pain of family separation, is this unknowing.
Right, right. Because the government wasn't volunteering any information about why they were doing it. Surprising that they started this right after Pearl Harbor, too. I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, this is immediate activity, which really goes to show the level of surveillance that was going on toward anybody who was involved with the Japanese community.
Right. And for these gentlemen in the camp in Santa Fe, what were the conditions like? Was it like the concentration camps in Austria? Or
not at all.
We've seen pictures of them playing baseball.
Yeah. The Santa Fe camp, and based on diaries and letters and photographs I've seen many of the other camps, the internees or prisoners were able to do a lot of what they wanted to do. In many cases, they were able to actually hold down jobs outside of camp, go work on a golf course, go work on an orchard or on a farm. They were in camp doing drama, theater, Japanese newspapers, baseball. They played the Japanese game Go. One guy told me he ran a gambling syndicate underneath the cabin where they had this game with beans. They'd take these beans, they'd have them all in a big pile, and then you'd do this game where you divide the pile into stacks of four, and you bet on how many beans will be in the last stack, one, two, three, or four. And, you know, the guy made fistfuls of money. And then he had a job in the mess hall. So obviously there were some of the complaints of food, but one Japanese national whose son, an American citizen, was serving in the war, visited him, his father, in Santa Fe, and they reported they were eating the same thing. So in some cases there was reports that in Santa Fe, they made an exchange with the hospital to get some extra meat or protein from the hospital in the city, and in exchange, the camp would deliver some fresh vegetables that the prisoners had been growing. Right. So you had, obviously, life in camp was without the freedom of all the things one would enjoy on the outside.
Right.
But by and large, the men were able to do whatever it is they could. They polished stones and made beautiful polished stones into bird shapes and brooches, and they made matchboxes and cigarette carriers out of the onion sacks, you know, that onion string that would be around the sacks. You'd put a bunch of onions in the field. They'd take these sacks apart, and using the colors from them and the different dyes, they would make these intricate woven little boxes and little cases, and really beautiful art, actually. Mm. And so, in other words, they had some time on their hands and they used it.
Well, did they ever mention like what their relationship was like with the guards?
Yeah. By and large, the men reported positive relations with the guards. I heard some stories where there'd be a guard who would yell at someone who was walking too close to the fence, you know, "Get away from the fence, you Jap." And the internee would, you know that, okay, this is a guard that obviously is not friendly. But no, in most other cases, if they were practicing golf shots, or if they were playing baseball and the ball went over a fence, sometimes, you know, guard would go off on his horse around the fence, get the ball, toss it back over. Now, there was occasional, you know, social interaction like that that reminded the prisoners that the guards were doing a job that they had to do, but the guards didn't necessarily harbor any great ill will. Right. In fact, one guard ended up drawing pictures of the activities in the Santa Fe camp, and this is part of the film that shows guards kicking back, reading the newspaper in the guard tower, one guard asleep. You know, it's really this tongue-in-cheek cartoon drawings of life as a guard in Santa Fe, with the very clear knowledge that these men were not in any danger. But they did not pose a real danger of escaping or anything like that. So there was, because of that, the relationship, from what I can tell, seems like it was basically neutral.
Yeah, one thing I found interesting in doing research, you know, about your film and this topic was this constant fear and question about the loyalty of these Japanese Americans. Who were they loyal to? To Japan or to America? And one thing I found kind of ironic is that one of the most highly decorated regiment in the history of the United States Armed Forces is the 442nd Regiment Combat Team, which is composed of Japanese Americans.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, they were fighting for America when their families were in the intern camps.
Yeah.
And I just find that just amazingly ironic that this unit, that's one of the most highly decorated units in the history of the U.S. Armed Forces, were out fighting for America, and then the Americans were questioning their family's loyalty while putting them in these intern camps.
Yeah. You know, just hearing you talk about it even gives me chills, because it truly is the most emotional part of the Santa Fe camp and of the World War II story for Japanese Americans.
Right.
These men gave so much for the United States, while at the same time the United States was imprisoning their fathers and families.
Right.
And it's a great travesty. I'm thankful that as an American, my government apologized for it, even if it was late and even if no apology is ever enough. But these soldiers would visit their dads in Santa Fe and share their stories before they'd go back out to the battlefield. And the fathers would write in their diaries about how they feel their son is doing a great duty. And they'd write with great pride about what their son, a sadness for knowing that they're going off to battle, but a pride for knowing that they're serving America. And to me, that was shocking to read the diary of a Buddhist minister held against his will in Santa Fe, writing positively about his son serving in the armed forces of the United States military. Mm. And it's quite amazing. And you can see some families clearly would have a conflict, a debate within themselves. But in many of these more traditional families, there would almost be a hierarchy. So if the older brother said, you know what, I'm going to serve. I don't want to go back to Japan. I want to serve. I want to prove my loyalty to the United States and put us in a better position after the war, then the younger brother would do the same thing. But if another case, you know, the family of the mom or the older brother said, you know, we're going to all meet up back in Japan. So you and your brother and held in Santa Fe and me and the cousins all over here in Topaz or wherever, we all need to tell all of the hearing boards. The hearing boards would be who would decide, you know, who could leave and not. We need to all tell the hearing boards the same thing. So if you get any questionnaire that asks you what you want to do, say you want to go to Japan. And if you get anything that is an opportunity for us to get repatriated back to Japan, you need to take that opportunity and we'll all meet back up at, you know, grandma's place. And so this would be what they would do. And then some of these kids would go, you know, wander now 20 years old and go back to Japan and literally find the old family home and reconnect. But you saw a lot of this through letters, a difficult negotiation within the family of, well, where do we go? How are we going to get from this camp to back? And, well, if we're going to serve, then how are we, you know, if the brothers are serving, how are the sisters going to reconnect? So these would be the challenges the family would face during the war.
Right. When you approach these men who are like you said, they're in their 80s now, and they're you know, they're getting up there in years, and they probably haven't talked about this issue, you know, since it happened. How did they respond to you wanting to kind of bring this subject up? Because you know, Japanese kind of usual response to problems is not to really talk about it. This isn't a country there where problems are usually aired out in the open. So what was their response when you said, hey, I'd like to, you know, kind of hear your story?
Yeah. For so many of these men, they had not spoken publicly about the experience. These are not people who had been out there, you know, lecturing widely about what happened during World War II. And as a culture, you're very much right, there's a much more private culture. Right. To not share, not even with immediate family. Right. And some sons and daughters would say, you know, I assumed that dad didn't want to talk about it because he didn't want us to carry that extra burden, and he just wanted to move on. And others would say, you know, the dads themselves, I didn't want to carry any bitterness. I wanted to move forward without any negative feelings, and this is what happened, and now I'm doing something else. I mean, it was this, you know, just it was in the past. So the first person I interviewed was Bill Nishimura, and Bill lives in around Los Angeles, and he had spoken at Tule Lake, and he'd been at this camp, and he had not been there, you know, for 40 years. Went there sometime, maybe 50 years, sometime in the 90s. And while he was there, he met with a bunch of professors and students. And through the interaction with them, he realized there's nothing but a benefit in sharing this story. And he felt such a great pride in knowing that he could help educate this new generation of people who didn't know much about what happened in the camps. And at that moment on, he says, and I use this in the film, you know, I never refused to talk to anyone, he says. And so he didn't refuse to talk to me. He unfortunately, though, was not able to connect with some of his friends who were in camp with him, who lived in Hawaii, and either they had already passed on or were not interested in talking. And it was through a longer process of getting family members and other people in the community to approach people about my film, in many cases on my behalf, and ask them if they're interested, would they be willing to sit down and share what they remember. And in one case, I had an elderly gentleman. They're all elderly, but Noboru Taguma in Sacramento wasn't really interested in talking to me, at least on camera. And I was going to be in Sacramento interviewing a couple other people. And I asked him if I could come by, you know, with the camera and we could talk about it. And when I arrived, he had his granddaughter there with some Japanese candies. His wife was there welcoming me. A friend who had also been in camp with him came over from down the street and shared some of his stories. And they were more than happy to talk on camera. And I'm so thankful. And I believe that many of these families are thankful, because in so many cases, the families never were able to ask a lot of these questions because they got the message from grandfather, you know, we don't want to talk about it. Right. And so to have an outsider like me come in and sit down for an hour or so and hear all these stories, I would sit next to daughters and granddaughters who were like, wow, I didn't even know that about my dad. I didn't know he learned how to play golf in a camp. I didn't know that he was part of the, you know, draft resistors, whatever the case may have been. And so that was a real special part of producing this project, was not only hearing those stories and knowing that I'm recording them for all time, not only helping families to understand their own families better, but also just the great amount of community support and involvement that really makes this film much more than just mine. I mean, the people I met online and in person who would refer me to one other person or get me in touch with one other institution who's supportive of this type of research, all of this stuff really makes the film much more of a community endeavor in a way.
Right. And let's just say, too, that your film is not to paint a bad light of America, right? It's not like, hey, putting a black eye on America. Your film is really to document the situation that happened to these gentlemen before they are gone, and then the story can't be told.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's really the main goal. And that said, it's almost impossible to look at the internment experience and not view it as an embarrassment for the United States.
Right.
But that said, that's the film is more for these gentlemen, their families, and for history. I mean,
right.
The Santa Fe camp right now, if I go there, and I'm actually going there next week, the Santa Fe camp doesn't exist anymore. There's a monument marker, but there's a neighborhood where the camp used to be.
Right.
And it's really important, especially for the community in New Mexico, which prides itself on having such a long history of diversity. I mean, a place that's genuinely lived under the Spanish and American and Mexican flags. I mean, this is a historic state capital in Santa Fe. And for them to not know that this happened in their midst, in their lifetimes for some of these people in Santa Fe, it's critical that these type of stories be preserved. And I'm just really glad that now we have a film out there that tells people, this is where the camp was, this is what happened there, this is who was held there, this is why they were held there, this is what the experience was like for them, and this is, you know, what our country did during a war to take away civil rights of our own citizens and the rights of Japanese nationals during wartime.
Right. I find this whole thing just completely fascinating. I was also fascinated to find out that this actually happened in Canada as well, in my hometown of Vancouver. The relocation camps occurred in British Columbia, Vancouver, and exact same situation, which I didn't know about. I don't think most Canadians even know.
Yeah.
The Canadian government was also actively involved in relocation as well. So I find it absolutely fascinating, and I'm so glad you're documenting this, because you know, eventually this story will not be able to be told in the first person.
Right.
If people want to see your film, how can they do it? Where can they go check it out?
Yeah. Well, we will have a few public events in the United States in the coming year. In February, we will have an event at the Northern California Time of Remembrance event, which will be held at the auditorium of the Secretary of State. And we hope to do something around that same time in San Jose or San Francisco. In April, we'll be doing an event at the Japanese American National Museum, and that's in concert with UCLA. And we will also be doing an event at the Ohio Wesleyan University in Columbus, Ohio, in April. And then we have...
Any plans for Japan?
We don't have any plans for Japan, and I hope through your show that if there's any community group or museum or school who's interested in doing a public event, that we could make that happen. Often I come out for these events and do a Q&A with the audience. Right. I can also do that through video conference, or of course, people can just take the film and host events of their own. And I really want to reach out more to the community in Japan through the pre-sales of the DVD. I've only gotten, I think, one or two people from Japan. So I really would like to reach out more to the Japanese community in Japan to figure out ways to get this story told. The film is in English. It's available on the web at prisonersandpatriots.com. And that's one way that people can order their own copies, and institutions can order copies to have on hand for libraries and for public events.
Well, that's great. I really hope that if someone's listening to this, I'm going to order a copy, so you'll have three in Japan.
All right.
But if someone, if you are in Japan and you are listening to this and you do want to reach out to Neil, check out his website at prisonersandpatriots.com, because I think this video, or this film, sorry, should be seen here. And I think that is an important message that many young Japanese, I think, should also see as well.
Definitely.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for coming on the show.
Sure.
Thanks again to Neil Simon for coming on the show. If you are interested in checking out his film, look for his website at prisonersandpatriots.com, where you will find interviews with the cast members, reviews, and screenings that are happening in America. His next one is in San Francisco on April 15th. So if you're listening to this in the San Francisco area, go check that out. You can also purchase the DVD from his website as well. Neil is extremely interested in having this film screened here in Japan, so he's looking for contacts who are able to help him do that. If you are a representative from a school, an NGO, a university, or a film festival, and you would like to show his film here in Japan, please contact him at his website at prisonersandpatriots.com, or you can email me directly at anthony@tokyopodcast.com, and I will pass along your message. I've seen the film, and I think it's fantastic. It's a really great moving story, and I really hope that someone is able to bring this film to Japan, and please contact me, because I'm willing to do anything I can to make that happen. Join me next week when I'll be talking to Sachiko Takao-san about her bicycle journey from Okinawa to Hokkaido. She documented her trip on her website, findingsachi.com. And what's interesting is that Sachiko left on her journey the day before the earthquake last year. She left on March 10th and rode her bicycle all across Japan. So it's an interesting look at what she experienced and what she saw in the different parts of Japan as it tried to recover from the earthquake. So join me next week for that. Don't forget to visit my website at tokyopodcast.com. for links to all the other stories that I've mentioned on today's show. If you're interested in being featured on the show, or you have an interesting website that you want me to talk about, feel free to contact me through Twitter at tokyopodcast.com as well. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye. I was reading about this one Japanese guy. His name is Gordon Hirabayashi.
Yeah, yeah.
And, his race reads here, like, it says, like, you know, he kind of protested it, right? And went to the Supreme Court, and
yeah,
they ruled against him, but they wouldn't pay for him to go to the camp in Arizona. So he hitchhiked himself to the camp in Arizona. And then when they showed up, none of the guards at Arizona, the camp, knew what he was doing there.
Jeez.
And so they told him to go have a dinner and a movie and come back, and they would have it sorted out by the time he got back. So that's what he did.
Yeah, I mean,
can you believe that?
It's really ridiculous. I mean, and I guess if you're on the West Coast and you're Japanese, of course you're going to stand out once everyone's already been taken into camps. But
right.
On the interior, it's, I mean, some people you could have moved to the interior and still been, you know, a free Japanese American, just go work in Chicago or Kansas or, you know, anywhere.
Right.
And I knew one guy who did that, but then he resisted the draft, and so they arrested him in Denver.
Right.
But while he was in Colorado, he was sneaking into a camp to visit his family.
Really?
So his family had stayed in California and then got rounded up and moved to a camp in Colorado.
Right.
He had already moved to Colorado because he was avoiding the exclusion area.
Right.
And next thing you know, he was literally every night sneaking in to camp to see his family.